Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Better Than Life, where we're rewatching Red Dwarf with comedians who can explain why it's so flipping great. My name's John, and I'm rediscovering my love of Red Dwarf after many years in stasis.
And I'm Fergus, very much a Crichton to Red Dwarf's Camille, besotted despite the obvious dangers. Joining us this week, Will Duggan discusses the iconic episode from Series 3, Marooned.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company and evolved cat. A fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than life.
Will Duggan, you are not only a stand-up comedian and Red Dwarf fan, but also a podcast co-host. National Treasures, where you go on some of Britain's best days out, launched in spring 2020, when it became literally illegal for all your listeners to go out anywhere. That is comic timing. Speaking of much-needed escapism, welcome to our super-relevant podcast about half an hour of telly from 1989. We have got some fandom admin to complete before we get to Marooned, so let's start wherever you did.
So I am ever so slightly too young to have been a fan of Red Dwarf in its originality. Obviously, it's been going on forever and a bit, several reboots. But so I was two in 1988 when series one and two came out.
That is a bit on the young side.
Yeah, a bit on the young side. I was not really there for the satire boom of the late 80s. I was more of the rusks and of myself quite regularly. Kind of that was my scene in 1988.
Probably wasn't that different, to be honest.
It would have been sort of like late 90s. When I was sort of 10, 11, 12, and those occasional nights when you either couldn't sleep or had managed to convince one of your parents that you couldn't sleep and you had to watch your adult TV.
So
that's my first taste, like things like The X-Files and Red Dwarf. I remember, I think it is a Series 7 episode where they are fighting a T-Rex.
I think it might be 8, I'm sure.
It is Series 8.
Apologies, I've immediately undone myself by being a series too early. And they're in sort of like a holding space and they're fighting this T-Rex, or they're being chased by it. And I haven't seen that episode for maybe 10, 15 years. I'm sure I've watched it now. The CGI would be laughable. But I couldn't believe that they were like, people being, and I was enjoying the jokes on a sort of, to make a funny word, kind of level.
Yeah.
But fighting a T-Rex, like the next day or so at school, being in year six or year seven, being like, oh, guys, George Red Dwarf, it's one of my favourite shows. I'd seen 30 seconds, and that's all there. That's where my love for it started.
Oh, brilliant. So was it the combination of sci-fi, dinosaurs, and comedy, that heady mix?
Yeah, I think it was. And it was as a young little nerd in Northamptonshire in the late 90s. Who was into dinosaurs, sci-fi, and comedy?
Yeah,
it was literally the only thing that existed that was all three.
Yeah,
and then sort of going forward into my early teens, when I found out that Robert Llewellyn was the host of Scrappy Challenge,
right? Yes,
because I'd loved that as well separately, and hadn't in my mind realised that he was Crichton.
Yeah,
and it's just it does occupy. I'm sure we're going to talk about the mechanics of it's just a workplace sitcom, really. You know what I mean? It's just it could be set anywhere, but it just happens to be 3 million years in the future. And I just discovered The Hitchhiker's Guide as well, so it really was
perfect
feeding me there as well. You know what I mean?
Yes. Were you sort of staring at Robert Llewellyn on Scrap Heap Challenge, then trying to picture him in the square faced mask, trying to piece all this together?
Yeah, couldn't do it. Like, because you'd see, you know, if you watched the British Empire, you'd be like, oh, that guy is Rimmer.
Or,
you'd watch Robot Wars and you'd go, oh, that's the same voice as Lister. And Daddy John Jules, I think, is just playing himself with fangs, to be fair, on Red Dwarf. But the Crichton Llewellyn disparity, even now, when I see him, I can't imagine him as Crichton, but knowing he is full well.
So when you saw the dinosaur episode, were you allowed to carry on watching, or was that your sort of one and done when you persuaded your parents and you sort of had to sneak back to it later?
It was a bit of one and done. In the case, you know, I wasn't always able to stay up and watch it, and TV being as it was at the time, there was no on demand. It was on this time on a Friday. That's just, if you didn't see it then, you didn't see it. You know how if you would watch Buffy on BBC Two, they weren't buying the full series and they weren't playing them in order. Same with Star Trek. Like, you would just watch, you could watch it 5 nights a week, but you'd watch 5 different series out of order. That was my relationship with Red Dwarf for ages.
Oh, that's infuriating.
Until about 16 or 17, I didn't realise that Lister was the last person in the world.
Oh my gosh. You'd not heard any of the setup?
No. To me, they were just far from home, in space, on a mining ship. I hadn't realised that Rimmer had been brought back by Holly, because he was like, he was bunk mates of Lister, wasn't he, originally?
Yeah.
I hadn't realised that the joke of Lister being the lowest ranked person. I didn't know that Cat was a descendant of I knew none of this stuff. So I'd just seen bits here and there. And then it really helped at about 16 when I managed to get my eyes on Kachansky. And then there was another whole reason to really watch.
Just out of interest, which actor playing Kachansky? Early Kachansky.
Early Kachansky.
Or Grogan, or...
Yeah. And I'm not anti-Lady Kachansky either, but...
No,
At the time.
No, I think she stirred a lot of loins. Oh, God, I'm sorry.
Do you know, I've been really worried about lowering a tone. Thank God you're here.
Just saying, we don't usually work blue. I'm sorry.
So, right, I'm really interested to know then, given the way in which you watched it all higgledy-piggledy, when you were younger, did you have a favourite series, or was it not really something you sort of conceived of in terms of series?
No, I didn't think of it in terms of series. I liked it in terms of it was quite anarchic and silly.
Mm.
But like the first time I would have seen it in order, start to finish, is like 2013.
Right.
Wow.
So there's so much of it that I won't know the lore or the history of, because so much of it was just episodes.
Sure.
I didn't realise, I thought that Norman Lovett, Holly and Patsy Herridge, I thought they were just interchangeable.
Right.
And obviously I've realised quite a long time ago it's not. But yeah, for ages I had no context of it all.
Oh, that's cool. That's really interesting. I mean, it's one of the things we sort of talk about every now and again here, because we like to just take stuff too seriously sometimes, is the respect or lack of for continuity from the people who are writing and producing the show.
Clearly doesn't matter.
And it's obviously, it obviously kind of worked to some extent in their favour that you can just kind of treat it like a pick and mix. In some ways, that speaks to just how great of a show it is, right?
Yeah. The episode we're going to talk about is a perfect example of that. There's a premise given in the first couple of scenes. Then, you know, it follows the beats of a 3-act TV show. And at the end, everything returns to normal. Mm. And I'm sure that if someone were to watch that as their first episode ever of Red Dwarf, they'd laugh, they'd enjoy, they'd get the dynamic of the group.
Yeah.
They'd miss a few of the subtleties of someone who's loved it for years and years. But it is, they are just brilliant standalone 30-minute episodes of television.
Yeah, they absolutely are. Did you have favourite episodes back in the day? And do you now?
No. The way I came to it with the pick and mix is that's still where I am with it.
Yeah.
And I think I prefer up to series 4.
Yeah.
Because series 1 and 2 were, 88? Series 3 was 89. So like 1990, 1991, because they are so anarchic.
Yeah.
And they're all so young. Mm. And you can tell, not that the reboots aren't good, and they are, but it's something about like Craig Charles is 28 in the first sort of couple of series. And he's this punk poet from Liverpool.
Yeah.
No acting experience, just gets thrown into what will become one of the biggest sitcoms. It's that nice 1980s feel. That I think I like those ones. Yeah. but more for the background, if you know what I mean. The writing's still great in the later ones. And
there's something about the budget, I think, as well on it. I mean, I don't know, honestly, how good of a budget it was for the time, but probably not great, because I don't think the BBC threw a lot of money at sci-fi, even kind of contemporaneously.
Definitely not comedy.
It's got a kind of scrappy, can't believe we're getting away with this feel to it sometimes.
They want to show that Rimmer's a hologram, and the only ever lip service they do is they blue tack an H to him. And that's it. Sure, the story develops, but it's just Chris Barry with an H on his forehead.
Yeah, and then when they want him later on to be able to touch things and interact more, they just go, oh, he's got a hard light. What?
Yeah,
well, amazing. I love it.
Well, we were talking about the continuity. So the episode we watched here, where they're stuck and it's really cold, they're having an argument about what to burn, aren't they? And people, you're a hologram, mate. You're not feeling the temperature. You don't really like your pals, so why are you that bothered? Just those three scenes could be gone by you just going, no. Or he could defy you because you're made of light. You just put it at his kids. Great.
So character-wise, Will.
Yeah.
So again, I'm really curious to know, like, when did have your, if you even have favourite characters out of the cast, you know, has that shifted between when you watched it back in the day and now, having seen it with context and some life experience?
Yeah, definitely. Like, as a child, so let's go with it. So pre-2000 Will, Cat was my favourite because that's the level I was enjoying the show on. It was a flamboyant, again, like a dancer, isn't he? Danny John-Jules. Just this flamboyant man who likes to wear outrageous coats and loves himself. I loved it. I didn't care about anything else. That just made me laugh. He'd turn up, he'd do a little spin on his heel and say you looked good. And I thought, yeah, do you know what? You're a cat man in space. That's all I need from you. And then as I got into my sort of maybe my 20s, you watch a TV show and you go, like, oh, I'm Phoebe and you're Ross. Like, I wanted to be Lister because he was, obviously he's an idiot. He's a loser. I also think it's very funny that it's 3 million years in the future, but they've made no attempt to try and modernize Craig Charles in any way. Like, he looks like the 1980s version of a rebel.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, that's what he is. Like, he's eating beef vindaloo. Like, that is just, I honestly think the writers went out and went, what do our dickhead mates do? Let's just make this guy 3 million years in the future. And then as I get older and older, I think I like Crichton the best because he's just, it's quite effortless comedy because he's obviously a robot, so he's so logical and all this sort of thing. The comedy comes from him not understanding the world, not him rebelling against the world. And I like that kind of thing. Yeah. Same with like Data on Star Trek Next Generation. He's funny because he wants to be part of it and is failing rather than being a bureaucrat like Rimmer or a dickhead like Lister or a dancing cat like her.
Well, you're a dad of a little one.
Yeah.
Have you already worked out the age that you might introduce them to your favourite shows?
I'll tell you exactly when I'm going to introduce them. As soon as it can hold their attention enough that I get 30 minutes to myself, they can watch anything. If she's willing to sit for 90 minutes quietly and watch Scarface, I'll put it on tomorrow. We can get a toy chainsaw and go in the bathroom and play afterwards. I don't mind. I don't care. Put it on. But realistically, 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, 10's a good age. So, Will, we've got a really hard question that we ask everybody.
Yes.
And I'm amazed by how easy most of them find it, because when we came up with this question, I thought it was a real humdinger. It's the question about recasting. If you had unlimited budget, unlimited resources, you were not constrained by the realities of time and space, how would you recast the core characters of Red Dwarf?
Okay. For Cat, I want 1997 Michael Barrymore.
Yeah, we can do that.
I want Strike It Lucky, My Kind of People, My Kind of Music, that Barrymore as Cat.
Before the swimming pool stuff.
Very much before the swimming pool.
Right.
Also before I was going to go before Celebrity Big Brother and avoid the swimming pool, but it's your podcast, you mentioned it. Yeah, pre-swimming pool Barrymore, but post-coming out Barrymore. That sort of sweet Barrymore spot. Okay.
Yeah.
I want him as Cat.
I watched Barrymore's shows. He was an amazing host.
He was an amazing host. He could sit. He was a triple threat. Well, a quad if you include the swimming pool. He had it all. You watch him go on Challenge tonight and watch Strike It Lucky. He will chat to a plasterer from the deepest, darkest Essex and have a great chat. Then he'll chat to a professor of linguistics from Oxford University and have a great chat. And then a 90-year-old Italian who misses Franco and they'll have a great chat. Like, Mussolini, but the point, he could work any room. So he's Cap.
Yeah.
Crichton is Matthew Holness.
Ah. Okay.
Wow. Matthew Holness now.
Yeah, I think now. Now he's a bit older. He's closer in age to the characters he sort of plays than...
Okay.
And then I really want my Rimmer recast to be a woman. I think that, particularly in the arts, women have had it too easy for too long.
famously, that is famously true.
Famously, yeah. Famously, women have a great time. But you don't get many sympathetic but callous female characters. What I'm thinking is maybe Jennifer Saunders.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like someone older, but when you get someone like Jennifer Saunders in a thing, she, and by she I mean that type of actor, is always meant to be a bit ditzy or stupid or mumsy or... But what I want is a self-serving, unempathetic... Mm. Yeah, Jennifer Saunders, I think, would be a great Rimmer.
I think that's a brilliant choice. And her recent acting choices, her recent career choices have shown that she can play...
Yeah, 100%.
...exactly what you're talking about. Mm. Abrasive, pretty nasty recently.
Yeah.
She's also got all the comedy chops. That's a sweet choice.
And then, obviously, Lister Hard. Firstly, I'm very aware that I've gone for, so far, 100% white people, and I don't want to be part of the problem. Thank God I've got a woman in, I'm part of the solution. And I think young. I need to be a young person. So who I think would be great would be Susie Wacoma.
Oh, wow. Mm. Okay, yeah.
So, and it's quite nice then, by making Lister and Rimmer female, keep that sort of power struggle between them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They can have all the same stuff, just through a completely different lens.
Different lens.
Yeah.
And then, who's this being psyche in the background? Wholeness. Who's that dancing around on his shiny, shiny pale leather shoes? Barrymore.
Yeah. Yeah. It works in a crazy way.
If you do want to recast Holly, I've had to do it. Because if I'm recasting, why wouldn't I give myself a job?
Oh, nice. Okay. You as Holly. There we go. You're the first guest who's done that.
Yeah. But only Holly. Not to detract from the character of Holly. But yeah, why not?
You'll be a part,
of television history.
Amazing. Amazing. That's a baller move. I like it. So, to remind us what on earth happens in this utterly iconic episode, Fergus is going to give us a little pricey.
Yes, if we need reminding. Awooga! Awooga! It's Series 3, Episode 2, Marooned. The boys from the dwarf are abandoning ship. Holly's only just noticed the source of their imminent destruction. 5 massive great black holes. And Cat, Crichton, Lister and Rimmer have to get out of Dodge fast. Cat and Crichton go in Blue Midget, leaving Lister and Rimmer to pilot Starbug on a very short-lived journey. Barely have we set up the emotional value of all the stuff that's going on the fire later, including Rimmer's priceless army dolls, his $24,000 pounds, a camphorwood trunk, and Lister's beat-up old guitar, when we're treated to a lovely long argument between Dave and Arne about honour and courage, and whether or not they overlap. It's also really funny. You'd be happy at this point if the whole episode was just going to be Lister and Rimmer bickering. Something Grant and Naylor seem to know too. A flaming asteroid smashes Starbug out of space, forcing us pleasantly into a bottle episode where the two men have to survive the frozen atmosphere, food and power shortages, communication breakdowns, and each other. There you go, iPlayer. They have a conversation about losing their virginity, which ends up actually being quite touching. To live, Lister needs to keep warm, so he burns books, he eats dog food, he burns a load of money, he burns Rimmer's prized possessions, lies about burning his guitar when actually he's burnt Rimmer's trunk, and gets rescued exactly when he's done the lowest thing we've ever seen him do. Rimmer is impressed by Lister's bravery, baffled by his lie, and then blood-boilingly livid at his dishonour, all in the space of about a minute of incredible writing and performance. Oh, and it turns out it wasn't black holes, it was just some grit on the radar. This episode is full of plants and stitchbacks. It manages to be an absolute classic episode of telly, and it shows us something we're not seeing before. Dave Lister sinking to Rimmer level depths of selfishness and duplicity. Will, is this ep up there for you? I remember this one standing out for me on every watch.
Yeah, it's great. It's such a good episode. As we said earlier about being able to watch them out of order, it sets up its stall within the first 30 seconds. Like Holly's warning klaxon. There are 3 jokes in those 3 lines that are all fantastic. Like, You could have never seen an episode of Red Dwarf before, watch the opening scene of that and you go, I know what this is. It's such a good episode of TV. I had also forgotten how funny it what it is now, and definitely would have been in the sort of late 80s, to have the ship's computer with a regional accent. Holly's flat vowels. It's just really funny. It's really good.
That's true. You have all the fun and flair of the opening title sequence, which is only two episodes old, this big electric guitar opera. And then, yeah, three jokes for three lines. That's compact. So many jokes in this episode.
So many.
It becomes so, for every such spare writing. It doesn't feel spare at any point, does it? Because you do have, like, yet again in Red Dwarf, a massive long conversation scene that verges on argument all the way through until something kind of almost brotherly happens, almost fraternal happens, and then goes wrong again. It's all so fast.
It's quite nice as well, because you do forget that Lister is the last human and Rimmer is sort of this shadow of the last person he knows. They don't get on. Yes, it's that conflict, but thrown into this thing, there's that moment where you're like, oh yeah, these two knew each other. And it's really nice that Rimmer's insistence that the chest, is it camphorwood or something? It's priceless, and these are 19th century Napoleonic figures. And this guitar is everything. They're all worthless. They're not priceless. There's nobody left alive other than these two who care about that. And one of them's a hologram. Like,
yes.
It's quite bleak at points, which is quite nice in a frip or a sitcom, you know.
That's true.
I love how they set up the stakes being all around the sentimental value of those things.
Yes. Yeah.
It's really brilliantly, like the fact that they burn the 24 grand first, because that means less than Rimmer's father's chest, which is the only thing he ever got from him, and Lister's guitar,
apart from a sense of disappointment there from
him. Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah, all wrapped around gags. It's amazing, isn't it?
But that's such a cutting line. This chest is the only thing I ever got from my father, apart from a sense of disappointment. It's been 3 million years. You're dead, Rimmer, but you're still saddled with this horrible complex. It's insane. And then another lovely thing when they're talking about losing their virginity, and it's on the golf course. And you know that the joke's going to be that Rimmer's unhappy that he's on the golf course, not as a member. But the writing is so good that they sort of edge that punchline out of you. You think, oh no, oh no, oh no. And not even green fees. What a line to be said on the ice planet of Hoth 3 million years in the future. Not even green fees. Really good. I also like as well the... I mentioned earlier about how Lister, he's not futuristic in any way. He's literally the 1980s example of a layabout. And just the little things, like he likes vindaloo and the food is a pot noodle. It's so jarring, but on purpose. It's just great. It's just great.
Yeah. There's scenes that should be a lot more shocking than they are. Like the book, but burning books is a thing that should make us go, oh, and clutch our handbags a little bit. But it is justified. Lister's staring death down the barrel, right? Like he really is. He almost accepts it at one point and then goes, no, I have to do stuff.
Lister's going to die because of the cold, but it's him who has the sort of bulk that Rimmer's never actually read Shakespeare. Like, he's playing both sides of the moral conscience there.
That's true.
And I'd forgotten how funny Rimmer's Henry V is.
He does it so well. It's so... Oh.
But the time getting into Richard III and then just...
Perfect.
Now. Oh, my God. What a... You know, it's used too much in comedy, but... Oh, you're right. They're wanting to have the weekend off. Like, if I'd written that, I wouldn't do anything for weeks. That is just brilliant. Yeah.
It's so Richard III. It's actually a good Richard III for that one second.
It's a good Richard III, yeah. And before he says a word, he does the hunch. Like, it's going to be now is the winter of our discontent, 100%. And then just the now, my God, what a brilliant bit of writing.
Can we get the elephant in the room out of the way about this episode, which is the fact that Lister does something bad.
Mm.
On this watch, I was kind of thinking, like, we see him eat the dog food and he burns all of culture. Is that about bringing Lister low to justify his evil scheme?
I don't think it is. I think that's just jokes. I like the idea that it's that, but I don't know that they're threading that this is turning him bad.
Not turning him bad, just justifying the desperation, the level he's had to sink to, which is, it turns out, Rimmer's level.
So it's like a self-justifying thing of like, I've eaten dog food, so sod it, I'm going to keep my guitar.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it being from Lister's point of view. Like, that's Lister speaking to an audience. I'm talking about the writers speaking to the audience.
I actually took it slightly differently than that. I thought it's more because he is, you know, he's work shy, he's lazy, he's all the things that Rimmer says he is, but he is about to die, he thinks, on an iceberg, the last person with a hologram of someone he doesn't like with him. And we know he's, by this point in the series, you know, he's quite money orientated. There's that great line about, you borrowed 15 quid off me and I got a £5 book. That was like, again, another great joke.
Yes.
Burns all the money. Burns the last, we assume, surviving copies of Shakespeare, all the culture.
Mm.
It's quite nice that even though he is all these things, he's willing to do this, he eats the dog food, blah, 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 just wants to save his guitar. Like, die on his terms, almost. Because what he does to Rimmer is bad, but I thought it was quite... Like, he bears himself. Like, this guitar means so much more to him than anything else.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, dying on his terms. That does beg a potentially tricky question. What was he going to do if they hadn't been rescued at that exact moment? Because I can't help it. I always imagine that scene. Like, Cat and Crichton don't turn up just at the right moment. And another kind of few days has to pass. There's going to be a moment where Dave has to go, right, I'm going to have to burn the rest of your trunk now. Or, like, just admit to it somehow.
Or maybe he was hoping that if it was going to get to that point, that he would be able to say to Rimmer, all right, we're going to have to burn your trunk now. And Rimmer would be like, fair enough, because you've burnt your guitar. And then he would contrive a way to... chop up the trunk and so that Rimmer didn't realise. But he can't have been thinking about the moment of being saved and having to reveal it, because that's just so... I don't know. I think it's just, to me, like, it's just really, like, presses on that sort of pain point around sentiment and nostalgia. And this is obviously not correct in terms of the time period that Red Dwarf is set in, but, you know, being a kid of the 80s, you I think we're all quite materialistic. We like to have things that mean stuff to us. We like to own Red Dwarf in a physical form, not just stream it and so on. And just, yeah, there's something a bit, it shows you something a bit dark about being attached to possessions. But even there, I don't think that's necessarily thematic. I think it's just there. But there's a lot about this, just seeing two characters, or one character confronted with his own mortality and another one who's just already had to deal with it and can't. It's that kind of storyline is always going to make you, it's always going to make you think in quite a personal way, I guess, as a viewer.
He's quite shamefaced as well, isn't he?
Yeah.
When Rimmer's being like, you've done something wonderful. Like, even before they're saved, he's thinking, you can see it. He's like, oh, what have I done? And then when they do get saved and he gets the guitar, it's a nice little bit of underplaying from Craig Chisel. Doesn't look him in the eye and just gets
it.
Yeah.
He does that shave face really well.
He does.
He's like someone who's just been recruited in the Traitors. He does have that look. Like, oh, God, I've done something awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not like, oh, this is a clever wheeze that I'm really pleased with. It's like, this is a desperate... I can't bear to burn this thing.
He's not a sympathetic character, really. Like, we're rooting for Lister throughout the series. Nobody wants to be Dave Lister. You might want to be as cool as him or as witty as him or as quick with a put down, but nobody's like, oh, when I grow up, I want to be Dave Lister. No one wants to be any of them. Like, they're all their own neurotic anti-heroes in their own way. But if I was watching, say, Parks and Recreation, and there was a bottle episode of Leslie Knope and Ron Swanson, and Leslie had done that to Ron, or Joey and Chandler, in fact, you know, any other sitcom, it would really change your opinion of that character. But for me, it was like, yeah, this is the kind of thing I expect from this man. And that's what I love him because of his idiocy and his foibles rather than in spite of them.
No, that makes sense. Oh, I've been quite harsh on Lister, I guess, in my thinking of this moment.
The whole episode's a bit weird once they're on the planet and we pick up with them having been there a few days. The whole episode is strange in terms of their character dynamic, because Lister, it's reversed in the sense that Lister is deeply pessimistic from the minute that we catch up with them. You know, he's not convinced they're going to make it out of this. And so you're in this weird situation where you've got Lister being really defeatist and Rimmer sort of boosting him, and actually Rimmer, as much as Rimmer can, Rimmer kind of doing the right thing and being quite a good guy and trying to save him from his instincts that he'll regret later on in a really horrendous situation.
You could maybe justify that through slobbishness. Lister's a comfort addict, right?
Yeah,
that's true.
So just that level of discomfort and desperation and pain, even.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I think wherever it's coming from, like that role reversal throughout the marooned aspect of marooned is really key to why it's such a good episode. Because I don't think it would be quite as good if it was just Lister being Lister and Rimmer being Rimmer for half an hour, because we have seen a lot of that already and it's great, But what really elevates it for me is the fact that you're seeing both of them, Rimmer kind of pushed to the edge of being as good as he can be, and Lister, yeah, pushed as low as he can possibly be as well, in terms of his spirits and in terms of his actions. And it just really gives the whole thing a real interesting, like, frisson.
Here's a thing that I may have missed because of the way that I have taken this media. Rimmer, the hologram of Rimmer, at what point of Rimmer's life is it emulating?
I think it's up to the point of his... He has memories right up to the point that he died.
So maybe that's why he's so nice. He's been in this situation. He knows what it's like to be stuck and have people die. Mm. If he has all of these memories, the character of Rimmer has lived a much fuller, longer, more experiential life than the character of Lister, who is going to be much more immature, being, what, third-rate technician, cryogenic because he's bought the cat on. He's a kid. He's an immature nobody, whereas Rimmer will have had, and maybe I'm overreading, but like a life on a mining ship in the dark recesses of space. There will have been moments in human Rimmer's life where you're like, right, pettiness aside, we're in a tight spot here.
That gives him a lot of credit, given there was only like 10 minutes ago you're saying he's a psychopath.
I'm saying, look, you can be both, can't you? Jeffrey Dahmer had a nice day. Not everybody Jeffrey Dahmer make you et. People can be psychopaths and friendly. There'll be someone out there who's like, Pol Pot, what a great guy, because it wasn't wake up, murder, murder, murder. Mm. He made a lovely chicken soup.
I think I read this episode was nearly called Men of Honour. I think there's kind of an element yeah, like Rimmer wanting to be the good soldier and all of that. But like, it's kind of a show for him to do the right thing survival situation.
It's camaraderie.
Less than anything, playing on his conscience.
And the Napoleonic, because he's got those figures. He's remembering, you know, the military standard of...
Yeah, exactly.
Napoleon, another psychopath who would have had nice days.
Yes, it's a chance to bring out, you know, that military element in his blood from when he was Alexander the Great's chief eunuch.
And not just any eunuch, chief eunuch.
The chief eunuch, yes, that is really important, yeah. I hadn't spotted that, you're right, yeah. He's got to be the most important of the eunuchs.
Yeah, of all the eunuchs, he's the best one.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Will, do you miss Crichton and Cat in this episode?
Yes, I do, because I always do miss Crichton and Cat. They're not needed for the plot. Cat, in particular, gets some really funny little lines at the beginning. The 36 change of clothes and 10 mirrors. Do I need more mirrors? It's not even more clothes would be the obvious. Do I need more mirrors? What a great line. Mirrors. It's quite a brave scripting thing, because Crichton only becomes a series regular the previous episode.
Yeah.
So they have him guest in a one on series two. They become a series regular with a new actor on series three. Mm. One episode, and they go, right, you're not really going to feature much in this. See ya. That's ballsy.
It's really weird, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
But it works, because then he comes, he saves the day.
Yeah, I was trying to puzzle out why they would run it second when, for all those reasons you just said, Will, and also the fact that we've just had, you know, an amazing romp of an episode in Backwards that really kind of explodes what's possible. And it's a really interesting choice to then go, oh, we'll do that two-hander next, essentially. And I was thinking, right, maybe it's to reassure audiences that, oh, don't worry, all the stuff that you loved, these two sniping each other, that's still here. In the end, I think maybe it's just because it's so good that they just wanted it early in the run. It's just like, right, we've done Backwards, and now look at this. Stick with it. This is so good.
Yeah, they knew what they had.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a hard watch either. No. Like, it's really, it might as well be a log cabin in an avalanche, right? Yeah. They've even got the snow outside.
Yeah.
It's not even sci-fi. It's a trope that everyone's going to get straight away, right?
Yeah. The most sci-fi element is the fact that they're the MacGuffin that gets them there, the black holes. And even that is unceremoniously got rid of. You know, the problem with black holes is they're black and space is black. And then it's just grit. Great, like not even a deus ex machina just an escape. Just it wasn't there. Everything's fine. Let's go and have some more adventures. It's brilliant.
Yeah, you're right. Well, talking of grit on the radar, had it been black holes, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't ask all these hypotheticals because they might just be silly and overthinking, but it's nice that this episode happens just in case Holly couldn't get round the black holes. But what was the plan if she couldn't? Like, is the idea that there's loads of food on Blue Midland? Or were they just going to float around space, watch Red Dwarf get destroyed and go, oh, well, that's that then. Might as well have been on it.
Who wants some dog food?
Exactly. Oh, the dog food scene is so well done. Craig Charles is brilliant in that moment. It's rank and he sells it so well.
Yeah.
What do you think it was? Do we know what it actually was, that dog food?
It's fillet steak, isn't it? Cooked in garlic butter.
tuna mixed with meat jelly, so yeah, not a whole lot better than actual dog food.
That still sounds pretty rancid. Wow, okay. Well, he's a brave actor, isn't he?
Meat jelly's not a fact. Do you know, Craig Charles once called me a wazzock on Radio 6 Music.
Hey!
What had you done to merit that?
I had got a joke of mine in one of those Times, you know, Jokes of the Fringe 2016, and it was a joke that was, in its essence, did a pub quiz in Liverpool the other day. I was too drunk to do any good, so just for a laugh, I put the Beatles or Stephen Gerrard for a re-answer. We came second. That is, in essence, the joke. But obviously, as a proud son of Liverpool, he was reading them through and he was on early breakfast on Sixth Music. He was like, oh, I don't know this guy, he's a wazzock. And I woke up to about 50 texts just from friends being like, Craig Charles just called you a wazzock on the radio.
Are you proud of that?
I am proud of that.
I think you should be, yeah, that's lovely.
He's touched my life through Red Dwarf, and I've touched his by annoying him briefly in August 2016. Do you know how he sort of came to the fore as a poet in the 80s?
No.
He was like on the sort of performance, poetry, alternative comedy sort of scene up in the Northwest. And he jumped on stage at like a music gig to do a poem while this local band were getting ready. But this band, quite well known in Liverpool at the time, but the poem was basically lampooning the lead singer of the band. But it was really good poetry and really funny. But then he got booked to go to open and do this poem on all of their little mini tour and did a John Peel session. Like, and he was 23.
What? Like, that's great.
You sort of forget because of, you know, he's so associated with Red Dwarf and Robot Wars and then, you know, the hard time he had with the drugs in the sort of mid-noughties.
Sure.
He's actually like a child prodigy of poetry. And he's so talented.
I don't even know if he's got... Does he have books of poetry published or anything like that?
Well, he has at least one because he won a competition in like the 70s run by The Guardian for like Young Poet of the Year. Like he is...
Oh my days.
He's legitimately very talented at apparently everything. There you go, Craig. Wow. Who's the wazzock now, son?
He's so good in this. When he listens to this episode, absolutely thrilled. That critique.
He will.
He plays it so real. He really looks like he's feeling everything that's happening to him. And I know that's acting, but I still like he does the acting really well.
The way he says "delicious" three times before eating that dog food.
Delicious, delicious,
absolutely, delicious.
Really,
and
telegraphs the disgustingness of it.
Yeah.
I'm going to tie some threads together here of all sorts of things that we've mentioned, actually. Robot Wars, Craig Charles having opinions about people. Going way back to the beginning of this episode, Holly says a wooga instead of sounding the alarm, right? A wooga, probably most people think of that as John Fashanu's catchphrase from Gladiators back in the 90s, the original UK run. It's also the title of a Calvin Harris tune from 2011. But this episode of Red Dwarf is the first recorded usage of a wooga. It started right here.
What?
Yeah. You might remember Craig Charles used to say it a lot when presenting Robot Wars and his virtual reality game show Cyberzone in the 90s, if you remember that. So I wondered maybe Grant and Naylor nicked it from Craig Charles, because I remember him saying it on those shows. But no, apparently he liked it so much that he picked it up from Marooned. This is what I'm told by the internet. Craig, don't call me a wazzock if it's not true. And John Fashanu, who made it famous, more famous than anyone on Gladiators, he was a guest on Cyberzone and he stole it from Craig Charles. So this episode,
the chain of Awoogas,
of Red Dwarf, yeah, it is. It's where it's the Awooga inception. It's an Awooga singularity.
I guess if you think about it, it doesn't sound a whole lot like a siren.
It doesn't sound like a siren at all. It's very weird, but it's in the Urban Dictionary now and everything. So yeah, this ep is a historic event, and yeah, the winner of Craig Charles versus John Fashanu will go on to face the winner of Norman Lovett versus David Ross in a steel cage, and they will not be allowed to use home-built robots as proxies. That is that's going to be our season finale. We'll be doing commentary on the Red Dwarf Beef Cage Fighting Championship.
There's a few runners that start in this episode as well, as Awooga starting the whole linguistic chain. Lister crashing Starbug as he leaves Red Dwarf. That feels iconic and classic, right?
That's the second time that's happened, though, because they do that. But Crichton smashes it in the previous episode. I think they need to get the tracking looked at. There's something not quite right with it.
But does he do it by accident? Because Lister does it on purpose, doesn't he? Because Rimmer says to me, like, no tricks, I was showing off. And then in response to that, he clips it.
Smashes into it. Very Lister. Mm. Yeah. It is an iconic moment, though, isn't it? That, yeah, that sparking. It looks great. I know it looks cheap and 90s-y, but it looks great because it's real. We always say this, but physical stuff is so much better than CGI stuff.
On the other side of the coin, I was really impressed with how much the space exterior shots had. And the crash of Starbuck onto the planet, it's obviously just like, you know, miniatures into a little petri dish of... But it looks...
It's real.
Yeah, I've seen less realistic-looking things made in the last 5 years. It's great.
Yeah, that's very true. They've got the speed, the heft of it just right. Let's not talk about the scene where Rimmer's pointing over Lister's shoulder at the flaming asteroid, because that does look like a bit of flaming bog rolling a while. But everything else...
Apparently, this is the first episode where the writers approached effects and said, what can you do which looks cool before writing a script? And then they...
Awesome.
Yeah. Wrote a script around it. Also, there's a cameo by the TARDIS in this episode. It can be seen in the background, when Starbug's leaving the hold.
I've never noticed that.
Well, as in it's one of the Greeblies on Red Dwarf's exterior kind of thing.
That's madness.
Oh my gosh, there's a listener. There is a TARDIS. It's just tucked away.
That's quality.
It's so much fun being a model designer person in these kind of shows, surely. Look at the amount of work they've done just on the exterior, just for that shot. All the painting and aging and detail. And you can put in a nice little Easter egg for yourself and your mates.
So, yeah, who mandated that? Was that like, did Grant Naylor ask them to do that? Did they just do that and hope and wonder if anyone would notice? Like, do we know the story behind why the TARDIS is on Red Dwarf?
Given the fidelity at which it would have been broadcast.
Well, yeah, I mean...
There's no way you would have been able to make it.
Surely that's been spotted in the DVD era.
Yeah.
It must have been.
Yeah.
I'm looking at that on an HD laptop in, you know, for 40 years after it was made, and it's not the best quality. Imagine that, a cathode ray TV in 1989.
Exactly.
I love that. Russell T. Davis, I know you're listening. You need to write that episode.
You could have watched this episode of TV from your flat in West Germany and then looked over and seen the Berlin Wall. That's the time that we're dealing with. No one was going to pick that out.
Well, they had more important things to think about, to be fair.
But in West Germany, they were fine in West Germany.
In West Germany, that's true. Yeah. In East Germany, they were like, oh, I'd kill for some dog food.
I don't think they were allowing Red Dwarf to be shown in. The Stasi weren't there. That was past checkpoint, Charlie. What a great Easter egg.
That's amazing. It's speechless.
It really shows the kind of people that made that. Imagine it. It's the same kind of people who... put gargoyles with their willies out on cathedrals in the 1400s. Like, it's just for them. It's just for them.
It is, isn't it? They know. They know. They know.
They know, yeah.
They're also doing other great work.
Yeah, but like, you know when you go and see a film and there's a crowd scene and there's always one extra who's being ever so slightly extra? Mm. I always like to think that extra and their family are all at their house... and they're watching it, and when that scene comes on, they get a big cheer, and I think that's why you've done it. I just love it. I don't know what that is. I just love it.
Can I drop a bombshell theory about this episode on you?
Yeah.
Is it completely symmetrical? It starts with this the discovery of the five black holes and ends with the same gag told in the same way, right? About its grit. The funny thing about grit is It's black, and the funny thing about space. Then after that, you get a scene with Kat and Crichton, and likewise, you get another scene with Kat and Crichton at the end. It seems the setting up of the camphor wood trunk and the guitar and the Napoleonic army soldiers and the burning of them, it all seems to hang around a central pivotal moment, and the second half is a reflection of the first. And I think the exact moment that it revolves around is the virginity story, weirdly. I think that seems to be the midpoint of the whole thing, or shortly after that. Maybe there's nothing to be said about that. Maybe this is going to be cut from the episode.
What I do know is which may blow up the theory, although I really like that theory, actually, because that's super cool, and it feels like the kind of episode where they would have done that, because it's just so perfectly written and so theatrical, and, yeah, it's just a brilliant contrivance all the way through. But I do know that there's a different beginning to the episode.
Oh.
It originally opened with Lister, Kat and Crichton playing strip poker.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's naked Crichton, and he loses his head. He has to put his head on the table, which actually that's a really bad effect even now. That does not stand the test of time.
That's why it was cut.
Oh, is that the only reason why they cut it? It wasn't that they went, oh, do you know what? We could start this more punchily if we just went straight into Holly having the conversation with Rimmer. Wow. It was just purely because they weren't happy with Crichton's head. Amazing.
Though, to give Fergus's mirror thing some more like weight or credence, let's pretend we don't know that about strip poker. If you're right, and you are, so the midpoint is the virginity story, does that then give Lister more sort of weight in what he does? Because Rimmer doesn't take his story properly. The Men of Honor thing, like if he'd, the whole green fees and that, if he'd acted more like an honorable man, like he's trying to be, then that would have took the basically Rimmer reversed the type, so Lister reversed the type, so the whole thing comes back in a nice palindrome.
Ah, that's a better way of saying it.
That's also really nice. That is really nice.
Oh yeah, do you know what? I'm going to say that Fergus is right, and that is exactly what it is. And hell to anyone that says otherwise, actually.
Maybe they shot an alternative ending where they were back to the finish off the game of strip poker, but this time Crichton's there kind of holding a hacksaw, looking really nervous, and Rimmer's just standing over him going, do it, do it.
Oh my God.
Brilliant. There you go. Perfect. Well done, everyone.
Do you have a standout moment, Will, or scene, gag, line, action, anything, any bit of this act?
The standout line for me is, and I know we talked about how good Chris Barry and Craig Charles are, standout line for me has to be Kat, do you think I need more mirrors? It's perfect.
Kat really doesn't have much in this episode, but what he does have, that's really good.
Yeah. It's such a good joke. Do you think I need more mirrors? I think having remembered the episode from the past, even as blurred as it is, and knowing what I was expecting, I knew what was going to happen, sort of, but I'd completely forgotten, and I did a proper laugh. Yeah, big bark of a laugh. Do you think I need more mirrors? Yeah, perfect.
It's really good. It's an on-point joke for the character. It lives in your imagination, because you imagine him with 12 mirrors, yeah. And that making the difference. Like, it's really good. Yeah, yeah. Oh, excellent choice. Thank you so much for doing our podcast. Thanks for giving us so much time on this.
No, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. And if any of you discover a love for Happy Days or Good Night, Sweetheart, I'll be back in a toot sweet double haste.
Where can our listeners find you?
I am on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Will Duggan. If you can find me between the pornography, Russian bots, and a real upsurge in videos of people dying.
Oh, what?
Yeah, so many.
Oh, it's getting worse and worse.
I'm there, but I'm sort of not really there anymore. Instagram would be nice, at Will_Doug, D-U-G. I'm trying to do reels. I'm trying to be young and relevant. You can come and see me at a gig. I'm all around. And I'll be at the Edinburgh Fringe this August every day. Don't know what venue, don't know what time, don't know what the show's about, but I've got a good title. And that really is half the battle.
Can you reveal it?
Can Duggan, should Duggan, will Duggan.
Very nice.
And if you're in Brighton, I'm often around the streets. Come and say hello. And if I look busy, in which case, leave me alone. Thank you.
Lovely Will Duggan and the brilliant Marooned. That was a really interesting conversation. It wasn't as celebratory as I was expecting it to be, but I think that's because we all know how amazing the episode is. So we kind of went we went deep
we're
on it.
We're very practical about how good it is.
Yeah.
And also his fandom is, you mentioned that outside of recording, he wears his fandom quite lightly.
Yes.
He doesn't have that fervour of someone who came to it as a kid or as a young adult and just goes like, ah, this is everything.
Yes, right.
He's someone who's appreciating it as a really good sitcom. It's short, it's in his favourites list, but still, the way he came to it is very different, and so he's maybe just a bit more moderate about the achievements of the writers and the performers.
I guess that's true. Yeah, he's not got decades of associations of this going back to childhood and being absolutely blown away by it. But I think that made it interesting, though, because I think you know, we all sort of treated it as a given that it's utterly brilliant as an episode.
Mm.
You know, it's up there as an all-timer, and what we ended up doing instead, I think, is just try and puzzle it out a bit, find something new to say about it. But I thought it was really intriguing that we'd all responded to certain aspects of the plotting, certain elements of the characterisation in quite different and personal ways. And I think that just speaks to what a great bit of writing it really is. You know, there are depths there to plumb if you choose to, and well before, if not that.
That is what we're about, but I think also, I might have taken it a little too far, clutching at straws structurally, talking about that symmetry of the episode.
Mm.
Like you say, it's there if you want to go looking for it, but the fact it's there... Surely you can't do this with other sitcoms. Surely you can't look at most other shows and go, oh, I wonder if I investigate this, will it yield any conclusions or any fun things? And it blimmin' does. Like, if you're looking for symmetry, it's there.
It is there, and I suspect, I mean, Will mentioned Happy Days and Goodnight Sweetheart, and Goodnight Sweetheart did tell a long-form story, which maybe that was quite new actually at the time, but I doubt either of those on a rewatch would quite elicit the same amount of discursive analysis as we subject our listeners to.
Maybe not episode by episode.
Yeah, right. You know what I mean? Right.
We might be really wrong about that. Maybe Goodnight Sweetheart's full of socio-political commentary and subtextual notes and themes and...
Yeah, it's true. It's got Nicholas Lyndhurst, isn't it? Yeah, so he's ascended to Hollywood. There must be something there to go back and seek out. Why not email us, listeners, at betterthanlifepod@gmail.com and give us your theories on Goodnight Sweetheart and Happy Days.
I think Happy Days is just an extraordinary thing on its own anyway. It's the central hub of a network of spin-offs and it's huge in American TV culture. Mm. Mork and Mindy was a spin-off of Happy Days.
Oh, yeah, it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
Like, it was the start of a lot of stuff, I think.
Yeah, there'd be no Apollo 13 without Happy Days. The film, anyway. I mean, the actual mission, I think, would have gone ahead.
In 2024, Henry Winkler's on a tour of the world. I think it's called The Fonz and Beyond.
Amazing. Oh, we should be doing a podcast about that. That sounds great.
Let's get this Red Dwarf one finished first. It's going to take us a while, and we need to concentrate. There are, for example, things we missed out, even though our conversation was thorough. We didn't mention Mayday. I love that little
bit of information.
Yeah. That's a cool nugget of knowledge.
Yeah.
Mayday. 15th Wednesday after Pentecost. So do you call that? But Mayday, it speaks again to the fact that Lister might be a more literate character than Rimmer. That keeps coming up.
Mm.
That whole the fool, the idiot savant, I guess. The fool who knows more than his master kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, that's another rabbit hole to poke down, isn't it? And figure out, you know, his various references to having read books or having never read books. You know, just even across the episodes we've watched so far, you know, to what extent that is the writer's finding a funny gag and not worrying about the continuity, or to what extent you're supposed to take any of it as Lister being sort of self-mocking. Who knows?
Or in this case... I reckon the most likely thing was that they were talking to each other about Mayday. I can imagine this conversation actually happened between Rob Grant and Doug Naylor.
Right, yeah.
Where one of them was saying, why Mayday? Why not April Fool's Day? Like, and the other one going, no, it's from the French, isn't it? And I'm going, well, that's so cool that we have to put that in an episode of telly now.
Yeah.
And everyone agreed, apparently. Paul Jackson was like, yep, that is, it's not a joke.
Yeah.
It's not a character moment. It certainly doesn't forward the story, but it is... a thing that we like.
That's a very plausible conversation. In fact, I remember us having a similar conversation about 20 years ago where you explained the origins of Elephant Castle, the London tube station / area. I would never have guessed in a million years where that came from.
It's the English habit of just assuming pronunciations are ours.
Yeah.
La Elfanta de Castillo was the woman who came over from Spain and whose name got turned eventually into Elephant and Castle.
So English.
Yeah.
Speaking of taking language literally, then, I've said before that I think Grant and Naylor have this really, it's a niche gift, but they really milk it, pun not intended, in fact, for food-based comedy. So the books with food names, Charles Lamb, Herbert Walk, the authors rather with food names, Charles Lamb, Herbert Walk, Francis Bacon, Harold Pinter. I love that. The list of food that they go through before they get to pot noodle, which is obviously not included because it doesn't count as food. But the list of food is just so perfectly calibrated. Half a bag of soggy smoky bacon crisps, soggy being key there, and half. A tin of mustard powder. Three water biscuits, that's what makes that. A brown lemon, again, that is the exact right kind of lemon to be funny. Two bottles of vinegar, because why not? Who's going to do anything with that stuff in a bottle of vinegar? And a tube of Bongella gum ointment. Once again, the specificity of the Bongella. The brand is crucial.
There is something alchemical in that. There is some genius in that writing, yeah. Right? Yes, specificity is the key in comedy, I reckon. That's a thing that's said, right?
It's a given, yeah.
But getting that level of specificity across such a long list of items and not have it feel like reams of information have to pass to find the funny stuff in it.
Absolutely.
It's all right there. And it almost feels like, again, one of them just opened their fridge and went, right, write this down. We've got a brown lemon, two bottles of vinegar. It's both real and perfect and perfectly perceived and communicated.
Yeah. Maybe it was just BBC Catering in 1989. But yeah, it is the specificity that they give to it is always just spot on, isn't it? Because you could pick any colour for the lemon. You could pick any flavour for the crisps. You could, you could describe them with any one of a number of colourful phrases, but they just always land on the one that's best placed to just be so vivid and hilarious. Yeah, it's a small thing, but we appreciate the little things on this podcast.
We sure do. And actually, that takes it back to something you were saying earlier on, that it's not always going to be the choice that makes most sense. Mm. Like, why would they have these things? Mm. No way someone's eating half a packet of bacon crisps on that shit. funny is the priority, I guess.
Yes. I wonder when the first half of the crisps were eaten.
I mean, it can't have been 3 million years ago.
Surely not. They wouldn't be. Yes, by Red Dwarf logic, they would no longer be crisps. They'd be some sort of crisp-based life form causing trouble left, right and centre.
That's true. Can I tell you something? It's not a spot. It's just something that I think if we don't mention it as a final point of order in discussing Marooned, then some of our listeners will be quite upset.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if you know this, so I'm just going to say it. Okay. I'm going to lay it out for you in one sentence. In the books, the planet on which they land in Marooned is Earth.
Oh my gosh.
The frozen ice planet from Marooned, according to the deep lore, the literature lore, is Earth.
Wow.
It's our Earth. 3 million years in the future, suffering from its presumably 8,000th ice age.
Oh, that's bananas. Of course it is. It's that opens up a whole can of worms, doesn't it, as to whether we really need to be treating that as a separate, I suppose we have to treat it as a separate kind of parallel universe to the televised version, just because there are so many extra bits and so many differences in the novels. But it has been really interesting how many of our guests have known and loved the novels.
For a lot of people, they're part and parcel of the whole thing. And I think it was about how telly worked, how broadcast telly worked in the 80s and 90s, where we were just so desperate for more. You saw across the Atlantic, Star Trek were putting out 24 episodes a season for 6 seasons. Yeah. And we were getting half hours. And there wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And the books do flesh out the action and the characters and everything in a way that, well, it should, frankly. I still consider them a companion piece to the TV show. The TV show is core, even though the books, as we've talked about before, have been higher budgets.
Yeah.
But I think they also do allow for those literary devices, callbacks that you wouldn't be able to do in a half-hour show, or even if there was continuity across episodes. Introducing the Better Than Life as being an addictive thing before Lister and Rimmer even get on board Red Dwarf. In the books, just so it's there.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be allowed to put that in a telly show.
Yeah, right. The whole Bedford Falls arc presumably would have run into all kinds of copyright issues. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And in this case, I think the boys from the Dwarf finding out that this is Earth, it would impact the rest of the show, right?
Yeah.
Where you could finish off a chapter or even a whole book with that line, oh, they find out it's Earth.
Mm.
But that's a shattering piece of information to Lister at this point. Yeah, and probably Rimmer. I don't think the Rimmer cares, really. There's no hope after that.
Yeah, right.
There's nothing.
Yeah, there's definitely nobody, unless they're all underground somewhere sequestered. But yeah.
Maybe it speaks to the fact that the TV show has to keep our spirits up. Whereas if they'd gone, oh, that's Earth, so what's the point of any of this then?
Yeah.
Then the show becomes a bit of a slog at that point. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Yeah. And clearly, given the rockin' theme tune they've introduced for this series and the changes of location and the introduction of bazookoids, they're not going for the somber tone this series.
Oh, bazookoids. We are going to be all about the bazookoids next week, actually.
They really come into play, don't they? Yeah.
Yes, they do. It's a right old romp. we've got Polymorph with some very special guests. It's our first ever two-guest spectacular next week.
It's extraordinary. We've got the mighty Kirsty Newton and the extraordinarily funny Nick Doody for Polymorph. It's going to be another classic ep, John.
It is.
I can't wait. Let's get to it.
All right, then. I'll see you there.
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.